Hey, it's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Katie O.
Mr. Chef in the Chapeau is in the country of Peru right now.
That's right.
Hopefully enjoying some purple potatoes.
Potatoes and all sorts of legumes, that's what I think.
I am chef owner of several Seattle restaurants, including Lola, Seatown down there in the Pike Place Market. Mm-hmm. If you want to sit outside and watch the market come alive in the morning, have breakfast at Seatown. It's always a nice place. And a bunch of others. Go to TomDouglas.com if you want to know more. We're going to be here with you for 2 hours today. We don't have a live audience today. It's not to say that they're dead.
That's right.
They're just not here. We are taping off-site today, not like the usual at the Hot Stove Society.
In a nice, tiny little studio that does not accommodate a live audience.
One of the good news about that is that we are right behind Seawolf Bakery. We had a little breakfast this morning. I have never been to their retail bakery before. I've only been to Manolin, the restaurant right next door, but it is delicious. I had a little caramelized onion and Gruyere Danish, I guess you would call that today, savory Danish,
yep.
And delicious.
It was delicious, and you were kind enough to treat me to what was a cheesy Danish with little blueberries on top.
Blueberries look like huckleberries.
We didn't ask.
Do they taste tart like huckleberries?
No, they tasted a little bit more like a blueberry.
Interesting. And you, Katie O?
I am the marketing director over at Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream. We've got shops all over the Seattle area and one in Redmond on the east side.
And you told me that soon you're going to be available in the Metropolitan Market stores.
That is correct. One of my favorite grocery stores of all time. Super excited to be there. There as well as PCC Natural Markets.
Angela Shen is here from Savor Seattle. We're going to talk to her about what's happening around town. She does those cool walking tours where people stop in and get a taste of something, and while they're on the tour, and they carry little signs around that says, follow me.
Yeah, little cute pink umbrellas, if I'm not mistaken.
We're going to talk about our favorite taste of the week, make a meal out of what's in your fridge.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, without Terry here, I'm going to be on the spot today.
You're going to have to really put your thinking cap on.
And, you know, you're pretty good at this too, Katie, so you should jump in there. We're going to go toe-to-toe on food for thought, tasty trivia, as we do weekly at the end of our second hour. So don't leave. We're going to be here for quite a while. If you can't stay the whole time, pop us in your podcast system.
That's right.
Yeah.
Listen to us on your jog around the lake, whatever it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. All right, ordinary to extraordinary.
Yes, this is normally when you have a little backup help from Tira Rotaro to make ordinary dishes extraordinary, but you know what? You're going solo. You're flying solo this time, Tom.
Well, I will say, Terry tends to take the ordinary dishes and make them French. That's his idea of everything becoming extraordinary.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that is the French way. I don't want to, you know, generalize a whole country of people, but I feel like, much like the Italians, they feel like they're doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese are the same way about this, too.
You don't mess with success.
Don't mess with success, and there are some ways that you can make things extraordinary. So if we want to play Terry's role, we'll just add foie gras or caviar or
truffles,
any of those things will do. The first ordinary dish actually comes and was requested from Jim McKinnon from our Facebook page, and he wants to know about coddled eggs. Maybe you could first tell us, Tom, what is a coddled egg, and then how you would make it extraordinary.
Well, I gotta say, the only time I use a coddled egg is when I'm making Caesar salad, and the only reason why that is that's the way I was taught by my mentor at the time. And so I don't dare mess with it because I believe I make the best Caesar salad dressing because he made the best Caesar salad dressing. Just saying, my buddy Kenny Rader passed away 25 years ago.
And his memory still
May 1st.
Lives on in his delicious salad dressing.
His little salad dressing. It's my ode to Kenny Rader. Anyway, so I take into simmering water. I take just a regular egg right out of the fridge if you want. And I just put it in the simmering water for maybe 20 seconds.
In its shell.
In its shell. The only thing I can think of is that it was a way to kind of sterilize the egg a little bit because you're using it raw, and the only part of the egg that could be contaminated
is the exterior,
right? Because the inside's still inside. So the whole process of breaking the egg and then opening up and having the raw egg brush against the exterior, that to me is probably how this happened, but I don't know. Because when I break it open, the egg is still barely any little white coagulation at this point. It's still pretty much just a raw egg. It's still cold. But I drop that into my bowl, and that's the basis of my Caesar salad dressing. So as far as making a coddled egg extraordinary, I don't really think it's an appropriate place to do that because there's nothing you're doing with that egg, you know, at that point.
Yeah.
Other than if you want to make a great Caesar salad dressing, then you can go from there.
I think we should talk about that amazing Caesar salad dressing because we would be remiss if we did not bring it up.
Well, if we talk about it, that's the last thing we'll be able to talk about.
Because I think that's fine.
All right.
We can't.
So I take my wooden bowl, big wooden bowl, and I put a small bit of garlic, depending on how many people. I only use a full clove of garlic if I've got maybe 6 or 10 salads going into that bowl. Because to me, a lot of people overdo the garlic in Caesar salad dressing. It's supposed to be an accent, not overwhelm the dressing. And no, because some garlic is good, more garlic isn't necessarily better.
I was at opening day.
So then I take from there and I put in a tablespoon of Dijon mustard, a couple shakes of Tabasco, a big squeeze of lemon juice, a shake or two of Worcestershire, which is not my style, but that's the way this guy always did it, a full anchovy fillet, and I take a fork and I just mash all that stuff into a paste. Then I put my coddled egg in. And I do that, and then I do my olive oil. And I'm not trying to make a mayonnaise. I'm trying to make a dressing. So many Caesar salads I have today are kind of mayonnaise-based dressing.
Yeah, nice and
thick. It is not Caesar salad.
Okay?
So it should be mustardy, lemony, a little bit of Tabasco. And then Parmesan cheese and croutons go in the dressing along with the lettuce. I like to dress all of that.
Mm.
I hate a dry crouton that rips the top of your mouth when you try to eat it. I want it dressed and warm and delicious.
I think if anyone knows you and has been to the Palace Kitchen and has the giant crouton, they would know you do not like a dry crouton. That thing is juicy.
That's juicy with butter and olive oil and rosemary and yum. Anyway, so that's, to me, a good Caesar salad technique. It's not necessarily a recipe because I didn't have it all with me, but it's a technique.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Ever wonder what goes into making rum? Sarah's meeting up with distiller Bridget Fertel to find out next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen from Large Media Studios here in Wallingford, brand new radio studios here. Let's talk about your ability to go find out how to make rum.
So I headed out to meet with Bridget Fertel, who's the head distiller and owner of Oni's Rum. She led me through the whole process of what goes into making rum, because I had never really thought too much about rum. I think a lot about how wine is made, or I know more, I guess I should say, about how wine is made. But rum, not so much. She also got into what you can do with rum other than just, like, your normal tiki drink.
All right, I'm looking forward to listening in.
Hi, I'm Bridget Fertel. I am the founder and head distiller of Oni's Rum. We make it in Brooklyn.
What goes into making rum? Like, I know what goes into the process of making, like, wine, but I've never thought too much about rum.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit of the challenge of making rum and the opportunity, as I see it, to educate people on what rum is, how it's made, how to drink it. One of the most exciting things about the actual category is that it's made in 90 different parts of the world in 90 different ways, so there is a little bit of confusion about how you go about making it. And each country seems to have its own stipulation on what to call rum. The only universal definition of how to make rum is that it must come from the sugarcane plant. So we actually make our rum, and most rum is made from molasses. We're actually using an all-natural, non-GMO, grade A sugarcane molasses that comes from Florida and Louisiana. We ship it up to the distillery in Brooklyn from the south, and we do all fermentation and distillation and bottling on-site. So we mix up the molasses, some filtered New York tap water, and a proprietary yeast. And we ferment that for 8 days in cold tanks at 75 degrees. And we get a lot of flavor from the fermentation because of the temperature we actually ferment at and for the amount of time we go about the fermentation process. And then we distill it in a way that showcases the flavor of the ingredients and the fermentation. So it's considered a low rectification distillation. It's not stripping it out to neutral. It's not taking purely ethanol. It's capturing the flavor of the esters that were produced during the fermentation process and the actual cane that we sourced.
What are some of those differences? Like, I'd always just thought of rum as alcohol made from sugar cane.
Yeah, I mean, there's, well, if you think about the category at like a 30,000 foot level, there's white rum, there's dark rum, there's blackstrap rum, which is like something you would have probably in a dark and stormy. There's spiced rum. So just even before you even get to the actual regional level, there's this total variety in the category. And then when you get to the different regional styles, it has to do with the cane. Is it made from sugar cane juice? Is it made from molasses? How long is it fermented for? How is it distilled? Is there any sugar added back after? Is there any flavoring added back after? Does it sit in a barrel for a period of time after the fact? So there's a lot of leeway there.
Do you guys make multiple types of rum, or do you really just focus on one type?
So the dream was, when I founded the company, to bring rum distilling back to New York. So rum was America's first spirit, actually. First spirit we distilled in the U.S., in the colonial Northeast, for sure. Our first distillery on record was on present-day Staten Island. And when I was inspired by that vision, I was like, okay, well, where do I see an opportunity in the whole space? So I thought that there was an opportunity to create a white rum that had depth, complexity, and flavor without adding any sugars, flavorings, colorings, or anything back, letting the ingredients and the fermentation process speak to itself. So currently we actually technically have three variants of our white rum. The first one, which we released about 7 years ago, is 100% made on site. It is made from a molasses that we source from Florida and Louisiana, fermented for 8 days. It's considered a high ester content rum, really funky, flavorful, grassy, smoky, banana notes, tropical fruits, and all. Like, most of that actual complexity comes from the fermentation process, and then, of course, the way we distill it. And we have that at 80 proof, and we also have an overproof, same production process. We just dilute it. We cut it down less, so it's bottled at 130 proof, really only available in New York.
So when I think about rum, I think about using it in cocktails, but do you ever do, like, rum tastings? Do you ever sip rum by itself?
Yes. Long story short, yes. I think all of the rum we make is delicious sipping, but I also understand the consumer. So most of our business is done in cocktails, especially our newest blend is amazing for mixing in all sorts of traditional rum cocktails. I'm personally on a mission to free the daiquiri from the blender. You know, I don't think most consumers know what a real daiquiri is, and it was one of the most classic cocktails, rum, lime, and sugar. That's all you need. It's not necessarily in a blender with a ton of sugar and a umbrella in your glass, although there is a time and a place for that. I'm not above that. But I think that the classic daiquiri should be on par with a martini or an old-fashioned or a Manhattan. And so hopefully the dream is that we get people to call for a daiquiri the way that they would call for anything else.
So if someone wanted to make their own daiquiri at home with Onis, what should they do then instead of heading towards the blender?
Right. So you just need a lime and some sugar, simply. But my personal favorite specs with the blends is 2 ounces of the Onis blend, 3/4 of an ounce of fresh squeezed lime juice, and 3/4 of an ounce of simple syrup, 1-to-1 ratio, just hot water, a cup of hot water and a cup of sugar makes simple syrup. It's very simple to make. Anyway, use those specs, throw it in a shaker, shake it up with ice, and you can pour it over ice. Traditionally, it's served up. It's probably the most delicious thing you'll ever have. No, in all seriousness, I pour these at a lot of events and things, and people are just enamored. What is this? What is this? I'm like, it's really easy to make and recreate at home. So it's an approachable cocktail that can be, you know, replicated for parties, or, you know, I have a couple of friends that drink a daiquiri every night at home, so it's cool.
So for people who are just getting into rum or who want to buy rum to have at home, what should they be looking for in a good rum? Like, what flavor-wise should they be trying to find?
You know, I think so 70-75% of the U.S. rum market is dominated by two major companies. And I think, unfortunately, that's what defines the category. And there's so much more to rum. So I just encourage people to explore past that. As we were talking about before, it's made in so many different parts of the world in so many different ways. And there's so much, you know, variety in what the flavor profiles can be. So it really depends according to taste. Like a rum agricole, which is a French Caribbean style rum, can taste like, you know, really briny and grassy and earthy. And then you can have super, you know, rich aged rums that are totally sipping, more sweet after dinner drinks, or can be used in, I hate comparing it to this, but like a traditional whiskey cocktail. And then, you know, for us, we think we're sitting in a totally uncharted territory with a really, really high quality, interesting white rum, which doesn't really exist at scale in the U.S.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, it's so awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Katie O.
The chef in the chapeau is off on an adventure down to South America, traversing Peru.
That's right.
Does anyone know? Have you been to Peru?
I have not been to Peru, so I'm really excited to hear what stories he comes back with, particularly the food stories, because you know me, I love a good travel
yeah,
for food.
Travel, that's why I travel.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine he'll be back for next week's show. I'm not sure what his return is.
Nope.
The week after that.
The week after next.
Okay,
he's gone for a while. He's really seen that country.
What are you expecting to hear from him? What do you think his favorite thing about Peru is? I don't think it's going to be potatoes.
You don't think it's going to be the massive starch onslaught?
No.
I think he's, knowing Terry, he's going to find some Michelin-starred restaurants in Peru, and he's going to think that they were spectacular.
I think he's going to, I think there's, if I remember right, there's a large Japanese influence in Peru,
mm-hmm.
and I think he's going to come back surprised at how good the food was, that kind
really?
Of mashup of Peruvian Japanese food is.
Mm.
Just
I guess
my,
we
my
will
guess.
Have to wait with bated breath.
Ooh, I don't hate the smell of that kind of breath.
Fish bait?
You ever gone? Yeah. You ever put bait on a fish hook? Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did that saying ever come from?
It
sounds
it's
terrible.
Hard to know. We'll look it up. We'll look it up for next time.
Okay.
Segment.
Abigail Gullo is here. She is one of the women who have shaped the cocktail culture here in Seattle, or is going to, I should say. And she is going to be bringing a cocktail. She's brought us a cocktail with many different sizes of ice.
I have.
You
yes.
have. And tell us, so what brings you to town? What brings you, what's your job now? And all the sorts of things.
Sure. I am the assistant general manager and bar manager at Ben Paris, the new restaurant in the State Hotel down on 2nd and Pike.
Mm-hmm. In the old Etienne building, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. It was, as a lot of locals are telling me, it used to be a teriyaki place and a wig shop.
The wig shop.
And of course, there was the original, one of the original Ben Paris restaurants was downstairs there as well. And I had a gentleman came in and told me he used to come in while his dad would play cards at Ben Paris restaurant, and he would play in the fish pond.
No kidding.
Well, the Ben Paris was also a sporting goods store.
Yes, indeed.
And so it was a restaurant sporting goods store right there at 2nd and Pike.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an eyesore for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And I know I went through with a hotelier a few years ago because he was thinking about buying it and turning it around. But it was going to be a lot of work and very many dollars.
They put so much beautiful work into this spot. It is just gorgeous. I love the space we're in. The windows. We have this beautiful mural by Kyler Martz on the inside. On the outside, we have a Shepherd Fairey mural. We're just surrounded by art, and then we're surrounded by the market, which is so key to all the ingredients and the food that we're using in the cocktails, and just being that heart of Seattle there and that go-to place for residents, for tourists, for locals, for industry. We just want to be that go-to place for everyone.
Yeah, when you step out the front door, you're greeted by the big market clock right there at the entrance. The newsstand and De Laurentiis is to your left. And straight away, you've got the famous Pike Place fish, where they throw the fish So it's a quite the location.
I feel so lucky to have just moved to Seattle and land right here in this beautiful spot.
Yeah.
I love coming to work every day.
So, go ahead.
And you're probably there right when that market is opening. I would imagine some mornings when Tom and I just love it. Love it maybe the most.
Walking through with Chef Quentin, mm-hmm. everyone, all the vendors know him. Hey, Chef, how you doing? They wave to him. They tell him they got some special stuff in just for him. Like, he knows everybody in the market. It's really great to walk through with him. I feel like I'm on a guided tour with the mayor of the market.
Very nice.
Let's get back to your origins, where you're from, and how you got involved in the cocktail world, and what can we expect to see down at the State Hotel?
I am originally from New York City. My great-grandfather used to work with Oscar Tuschinski, the creator of the Wardolph salad at the old Wardolph Astoria Hotel.
Yeah. Wow.
So I do have this like lineage. My grandpa taught me how to make a Manhattan when I was 7.
In Manhattan.
So convenient, too, because if you teach your kid, then they can just go and make you a Manhattan when you need one.
When you're one of 46 grandchildren, you do whatever you can to stand out to grandpa so he remembers you. Like, nice. here's me. It's Abigail with the bar cart rolling in. So I always had a love of classic cocktails growing up and didn't really have a time to implement it in my life until I started really getting into the fine dining scene in New York and realized that there was a hole in the market. I was going to wonderful cocktail bars. I was going to wonderful restaurants, but there wasn't good food at the cocktail bars and there wasn't good cocktails at the restaurants. So I said, I really want to bring these two worlds together because I love these two worlds. So I kind of started, and luckily, being in New York City at the time, at the turn of the 21st century, there was this golden age of bartending happening. Mm. So I got to learn from some of the best and decided that I wanted to continue to learn from the best and move to New Orleans, Louisiana, where I worked with Chef Nina Compton at Compère Le Pen in the Warehouse District and really loved the culture of New Orleans and found it very similar to my New York City upbringing. But still a nomad and adventurer like my French-Canadian ancestors, I followed in their footsteps through the Louisiana Purchase and ended up on the West Coast, just like my ancestor who was on the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
Nice.
I finally made it.
And here you are in the Pacific Northwest.
Here I am.
I bet they wish that at the end of the Lewis and Clark Expedition there in Vancouver, Washington, that they would have run into a fine cocktail bar. That would have been awesome.
So now that you're in the Pacific Northwest, you're here in Seattle, where are you taking your inspiration from for cocktails?
I'm definitely inspired by the history of the city. Mm-hmm. I've always loved like delving into the history of the city. One of the cocktails we're going to have today is called The Seamstress. And in my research about early Seattle, I come to find out that the tax revenue, 80% of the tax revenue for the city of Seattle over a 10-year period came from seamstresses.
Wow.
And those early days. And I was thinking, wow, there must be so many great clothing factories. Oh, no, wait. Seamstress means something else. Mm-hmm. So this is an Armagnac cocktail. And I often tell people when I'm explaining to them what Armagnac is, that it's like cognac's sluttier, more fun cousin. So that's the seamstressing. So that cocktail is called the Seamstress. It's light, refreshing, low ABV cocktail, kind of a play on an Aperol spritz in a paper plane.
Wow, fun.
All right, let's see it.
All right, so we're just going to do a little bit of lemon juice. Oop, I got a little lemon juice in here. And we have our Seamstress, which is Aperol and Armagnac and a local Amaro made from letterpress. So, again,
and Amaro is generally just wine with a lot of herbs or a distillation herbs?
It's a distillation with herbs, bitter herbs, sometimes a little sweetener. This particular gentleman who makes this Amaro is inspired by his grandfather who came from Abruzzo, Italy, and had a liquor store in Rome. And loved the Amaros and the limoncellos that he would have when he went and visited his family. So I related to that as well, since that's my other side, is Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And a little ice cubes in here. And we're going to give it a good little shake.
None of this slowberry blue gin?
That's for my next drink, which is the Gin Griffey Juniper.
Ah.
That would make sense why there's a little cocktail pick I see with a baseball.
Yes, I am
very
a huge
adorable
baseball fan.
Are you?
I am so excited to be in a city with a real baseball team.
Oh, as opposed to where you've been where you feel like you haven't had a real baseball team?
Well, we have three sports in Louisiana: high school football, college football, and the Saints. A little champagne on top. This is like a woman sighing. That's what it should sound like when you open champagne. Let's see how I do. Oh, not too bad.
Not too bad.
Usually mine is like a woman screaming.
Well,
a little
right.
I know, exactly.
And that is our seamstress. A little lemon twist on top. So just to give it a little aromatics.
It's a beautiful burnt orange. We'll post a picture on our Facebook page if you want to see what it takes look take, what it looks like. And then we only have a minute or so for the Ken Griffey, or the Gin Griffey.
The Gin Griffey Juniper, nice big cubes of ice. Today we're going to be using different gins depending on what we find seasonal in the market, and we're going to have some nice gins that go with it. So this is a little slow berry blue gin, and we're going to have a little fresh citrus, thyme, grapefruit, lemon, lime, and blackberries.
Yum.
And then just a little fresh tonic poured on top.
These are big cocktails that you make.
Well, I wanted to make enough for everyone here.
Oh, okay.
So these are, but this is a Spanish style gin and tonic, which is served in a large goblet that has a little bit more gin, a little bit more tonic rather than gin. And so it's those refreshing hot Spanish summer days, and has beautiful aromatics that are released through that large goblet shape.
And again, kind of the perfect thing that I would personally want to drink if I was at a baseball game on a sunny day, a nice big
drink.
Well, I like it especially because it's not overly sweet. Mm-hmm. And it's got enough liquid in it that you can nurse it for a while.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is served on our bar cart. Four or more people order this at the bar, and we will come with a bar cart to your table with all the botanicals and fruit and gin and tonics that you could choose yourself.
Delish.
Lovely. Lovely, lovely. Abigail Gullo is our guest from the State Hotel, the new hotel down at 2nd and Pike in downtown Seattle. Up next, it's our Taste of the Week. Looking forward to that on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're here for the large media studios here in Wallingford, and we are just behind Seawolf Restaurant and Manolin Restaurant here, maybe a block west of there. So
yes.
I miss our live audience, though.
I do, too!
If you want tickets and become part of that, please go to hotstovesociety.com. I'm Tom Douglas, chef owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants. We have much more to come in the next hour, right? We've got our tasty trivia. We've got Angela Shen is going to be here from Savor Seattle.
Got a little what's in your fridge.
And we're going to head to the ballgame and find out some of the new foodstuffs that are at the new T-Mobile Park.
Super fun. Was that opening day this past week, so it was a really good time.
They had a big opening day.
Oh, my gosh. It was super fun. Everyone that I was talking to is like, oh, they're going to lose. The Mariners are going to lose to Boston. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that is a very depressing idea of an opening day. But we kicked their on opening day, which was such a blast.
Five home runs in one day. That's a pretty good game. Taste of the week. I'm going to jump right in.
Sure.
I talked about it a little bit at the beginning of the show, but I just kind of wanted to explore why it was good.
Yeah,
because
sure.
I think
I like that
it was a pastry that technically was pretty flawless, right? So the croissant kind of Danish dough was very leavened. So it was at Seawolf Bakery because it's right around the corner from us here. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's so pretty in there. I love walking in the bakeries where you can actually see the bakers and doing their thing. If you go to Sirius Pie Westlake and look down, you can see our pastry kitchens that produce the pastries for our restaurants. And it's so fun to just sit there and watch all the action. And the same thing at Seawolf. It's wide open. You can see them making bread and rolls. And
it smells beautiful in there, too. That's part of it, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's a whole speed rack. You know, what we call a speed rack is a bun pan rack. A bun pan rack is, I want to say, 18 by 21 is a bun pan. It's very typical throughout restaurants and throughout the world. All that being said, on this little rack, there was a lineup of different pastries. One you got, which was more of a blueberry pastry.
Yes, like a blueberry Danish, and it was delicious.
Yeah.
Not too sweet, which is what I really loved about it. Sometimes sometimes you get those pastries and they're kind of cloying in a funny way. It's too much for me personally early in the morning, but the tartness from the berries and the freshness of that kind of creamy cheese, I'm not sure what they used in that particular Danish, but it was perfect.
So right under that, I saw one, and it was a savory Danish.
Yeah.
And the minute she said it, I had to have it, right? It was caramelized onion and Gruyere, cave-aged Gruyere. Mm-hmm. And so I got it. I took my first bite, and oftentimes, and matter of fact, just a week ago or so, Sarah, you might remember, like when we were doing our onion caramelization on the radio, and I did it on Evening Magazine the following day because I thought it was interesting how much people don't realize how long you have to cook those onions to get to that great caramelization. This one, this Danish, if you remember when we talked about it, we had the raw onions in the pan, and then we had them when they were half cooked, so they're still kind of full of moisture, and depending on how fast you cook them, they can still have a little bite, mm-hmm. or they're just soft and wimp and a little bit brown, or then they get a little crispier when you take them all the way to the kind of almost black. So this one was kind of three quarters, these onions. But what I liked about it in the Danish was that they were still a little bit soupy. And so when I bit into it, I was surprised to have that kind of moisture in my Danish with that crispy edge of the perfect Danish. It was just a classic combination. It tasted like onion soup in a roll.
Who doesn't want that?
That French onion soup, right?
So good.
It kind of tasted like that in a roll. And I love the amount of moisture. I was surprised by it.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the amount of moisture in that pastry. So if you're ever down on Stone Way and you want to go to, I want to say it's just north of 36th and Stone Way, you can go into Seawolf, a great little bakery, and try their onion cheese Danish.
And probably, grab a loaf of bread on your way out, too. Beautiful.
Sure, why not?
Why not? You're there. You're already there.
You know, I think it's them that, I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's them that make that great little olive loaf at the Ballard Market.
I don't know about
outdoor
this
farmer's
olive
market
loaf, but I believe it. That
it almost looks like a pretzel, but it's full of olives, and it's really delicious.
Yum. Well, Tom, I have two updates for my Taste of the Week. One has to do with something we talked about on this show a couple weeks ago, and the other is a recommendation that you've been giving me for kind of a while now. So I'll start with the radio show topic. We had Andrea Nguyen on the show, and we're talking about fried shallots and whether you should buy them or whether you should make them. And you and Terry were like, you should really just make them.
And why did we? Why? Because?
Because, then you have the oil that is delicious.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of byproduct with making your own that you would not get from a store-bought version. And they are actually quite different.
They're fresh.
When it comes down
fresher.
To it, they taste fresher. You can get them really nice and dark and caramelized versus the ones that you buy pre-made, which are a little bit more like the French's onions, which I think we're all kind of familiar with. But I went through the process of making them. I will say it was a little bit painstaking because you have to, peel the shallots and da-da-da-da-da. There's a process to it. But I had those shallots for the remainder of the week because I made so many, and they were just so delicious on top of all the little salads that I was making and bringing to work with me, on top of fluffy basmati rice. I mean, there were just a lot of ways to use them once I had them.
I think the word I would use for them is they're dynamic. Right? Because, like, when you put in green leaf into your salad, green leaf lettuce, it's there, and it's either crunchy or it's not, but it doesn't change your salad a lot, right? But when you put in these toasted, or what I call sometimes bittersweet shallots, because you're taking them all the way to a dark golden, and that sugar turns, just like creme brulee, right? The sugar crust gets a little bitter when you blacken it. Same with these shallots. They get a little bit of sweetness, but along with the bitterness of being dark.
That's right.
And they are dynamic in the flavor profile of anything that you use them in. So you don't want them to overwhelm your salad.
No.
But they are awesome. In anything.
So. Just so good in so many different applications that week that I felt like, woof, what a taste of the week. The other one that I would say is I went to Peony Kitchen over in Bellevue, and much to your recommendation, and had just a full-on delicious meal there. It was really hard to go through that menu and decide between me and one other person that was with me, my husband that was with me, like, what are we going to get off of this menu to really satisfy kind of trying a couple different areas? Mm-hmm. So we got some of the salt and pepper prawns that were were super, super delicious and fresh. A fried rice that had chunks of delicious meaty ribeye on top. I mean, everything that we had was quite good, including their xiaolongbao, their own version of that dumpling.
Soup dumpling.
Yeah, loved it. So thank you for that recommendation.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you go, you got to, even though it's like $47 or $48, you got to get the whole duck. It's really good. It comes with bruleed lemons and homemade steam buns mm-hmm. and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And their whole seafood, like the whole black bean sauce crab.
Yeah, I saw that
delicious.
On there.
Again, they're expensive, but it's a great share dish.
Mm-hmm.
So what I find there is what I don't find in most Chinese restaurants, and I it's hard to say this without coming across as judgmental,
mm-hmm.
but you have to go to places like Hakkasan in New York or down in Miami or to get that high-end Chinese experience. So often it's good food, but it's not in the nicest place or blah, 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 blah. And I'm not trying to generalize, but I'm just saying what I really love about Peony is that you go there and it feels special.
It does.
And the menu feels special, and they're doing a little kind of modern twist on some classic dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, black bean sauce crab is not new.
No.
Peking duck is not new.
But to your point.
But it's different there.
It is different, and the way that they present it is much different. So if you were going to have like a little special date night out, and your date loves Chinese food, that would be a really great place to go.
Yeah, super fun. And just take an Uber or something like that. Up next, we're going to go to the ballpark. Tina Knoll, our producer here, went to the ballpark to check out all the new food options at T-Mobile Park on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Tina Knoll, producer of Seattle Kitchen. And one of the cool things about my job is the perks. Not only do I get to hang out with Tom and Terry and Katie every week for the show, but I often get invited to restaurant openings and super fun foodie events. And one of my favorite events of all time is one that happens at the very beginning of baseball season.
You don't win, it's a shame, for it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
See, every year, just before the season starts, the Mariners invite the media to come to the ball field to preview all the awesome food available for the season.
Good afternoon. I'm Rebecca Dale with the Seattle Mariners, and welcome to T-Mobile Park.
It's a super fun day because we sort of get to eat our way through the menu. This year, I brought my friend Kevin Hallstrom, who is a big Mariner fan with a foodie routine when it comes to the ballpark.
I usually stop at the Hempler's stand, and I'll get like the jalapeno cheddar deal. I love that thing. I love that.
I brought Kevin because I wanted to introduce him to chef and restaurateur Ethan Stoll.
Ethan, this is Kevin.
Hi, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
Ethan has been the man behind the food at the Hit It Here Cafe for the past 9 years. Kevin was super excited to meet Ethan and get some insider tips.
So yeah, just curious what's new and what you recommend this season.
Well, if you're walking around, you know, go down and get Woody's. Go down to the pen and get Woody's burger.
Okay.
If you want to sit down, go up to Hit It Here. That new Crowd Cow and local chef program we've got going on is pretty cool. So both those, then go to get some Shug's ice cream. Stuff's delicious.
All right, what are you going for first?
I think it's the Big Woody Burger right here. Big Woody Burger.
Go get one.
Heard a lot.
Marcus is over there right now.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, say hi to him.
I will.
He's a nice guy.
Awesome.
So Kevin headed off to get his burger, but I, don't tell Tom and Terry this, recently switched to a plant-based diet. That means no meat, no dairy, and no eggs. And so super limited choices when it comes to baseball games. But much to my surprise and joy, there is something new for people like me. You can find Beyond Burger, a fully plant-based spot, at the Hit It Here Cafe. I was super excited to try it out. And Ethan said it's not that bad.
I've tasted it. It's pretty good, but I'm also like wondering, like, why does this taste like meat?
I wondered, too. So I headed over to Beyond Meats and asked Allison Aronoff what the deal was.
We use potato starch and coconut oil for juiciness and texture. We use a blend of pea, fava bean, and brown rice protein, which in addition to giving more protein than its animal-based equivalent, it also helps with that chewy, fibrous, meaty texture.
Cairo's Rachel Bell also really liked the Beyond Burger.
It's definitely tastier than any veggie burger I've ever had.
Which I think is a giant compliment, because if you listen to her podcast, Your Last Meal, you know what an awesome foodie she is and what an eclectic palate she has. So I'd say that's saying a lot. Hey, I also tried the hot dog over at Beyond Burger, and it was awesome. And just like they were saying, it had that same meaty texture as a hot dog. And I put a little ketchup and mustard on it. Didn't even know it wasn't a real hot dog. All right, so if you are not a vegan like me, and most of you probably aren't, there's lots of really tasty new options at the ballpark. Paseo is there this year for the first time with that delicious Cuban sandwich. And Ethan Stoll also added Ballard Pizza to the Hit It Here Cafe menu. And they're also featuring burgers from Crowd Cow, which is that hyper-locally sourced beef. And I hear it's really delicious. So what Ethan is doing is he's inviting some of Seattle's top chefs, like Maria Hines from Tilth, John Sundstrom from Lark, Brady Williams from Canlis, and even Mitch Mayers from Sawyer. They're all going to come by and create a rotating menu of chef-inspired Crowd Cow burgers throughout the season. So you're going to want to check that out every time you hit the ballpark. And what experience at the ballpark wouldn't be complete without a tasty cocktail? Kevin tried something he really liked.
Teens, it's the Magenta Mojo. Hold on, I don't know what's in it exactly.
It comes with a light in it or something weird.
Oh, yeah. There is a light in it. It's T-Mobile Park specialty cocktail created by somebody, Anu Apte, featuring a refreshing low alcohol by volume 8% combination of Tito's vodka, Lillet liqueur, pamplemousse rose liqueur, hibiscus extract, Peychaud's bitters, and club soda.
Before I left, I wanted to make sure to touch base with Ethan Stoll one more time to find out what he likes to eat when he's watching a Mariners game.
Ethan, what about a sit-down knee long, like a seventh inning stretch? What are you going for?
Seventh inning stretch? At that point, I'm probably on ice cream. I'm getting Shug's ice cream. I mean, I get there at the beginning. If I go to the games, I usually bring my kids, and first thing they want to do is hammer down some food. So at that point, then it's Cracker Jacks and all the stuff that's in the song.
Awesome.
Team's already off to a super great start this season. I hope they kill it this weekend and that we end up with a winning baseball team this year in Seattle. Again, I'm Tina Knoll, producer of Seattle Kitchen here on Cairo 97.3 FM.
Never get back, let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, for it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
We're back in the Seattle kitchen, minus the chef in the chapeau who's in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
We have asked Abigail Gullo to come back and be part of our What's in Your Fridge segment. Katie, did any interesting fridges come in?
Oh, we always have interesting fridges that come in. We went to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. We asked you what was in your fridge. What do you need help with? How can we assist in getting your fridge cleared out pretty much? So, shall we jump into it? Now, Abigail, you're here because you feel like maybe Chef Tom Douglas is going to make something out of these fridges, and you're going to do a little pairing, cocktail
pairing. Oh, absolutely. This is one of my favorite segments on the show, and I love to, in my head, always come up with, what would I pair with that on the drink side?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we are excited to see what you've been thinking about privately when you've been listening to the show. All right. The first fridge comes from Alexis Carson. Mozzarella, salami, tomato paste, plain Greek yogurt, eggs, pickles of all sorts, and lucky you, she says, a half pound of fresh enough green beans. Fresh enough.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Does that mean like they're slightly wilted or they've been in the fridge for a while? They still look good, but they've been in the fridge for a week.
That's what I think. I think that maybe they've been in the fridge for a week. They're not at their prime anymore, but they're probably perfectly edible.
Like, this is the day.
This is the day. We are doing it now. Yeah. Now is the time.
All right, so we're going to use the beans, because that's the largest group here, it seems like to me. Mm-hmm. We're going to use the beans as kind of the base of our dish.
Okay.
And we're going to blanch those, which is just, you know, some simmering water, pull them out of there. And I'm hit or miss on whether or not I would like to give them an ice bath. Sometimes I feel like when you do that, you're washing away flavor. Other right. times when you do it, you're, you know, preserving color. So mm-hmm. I'm always more about flavor than color. But since we want our beans to be cold anyway for my particular presentation here, I think that we're just going to go ahead and shock them so that they have a nice green color, okay?
Okay.
And then I'm going to take the salami and I'm going to mince it up into little eighth-inch cubes or so.
Little bite-sized.
And I'm
going to
crispen those. So those just go into a sauté pan, and we're going to have little crispy salami bits for kind of a little garnish on top. The mozzarella and the green beans are going to make up the salad. And then we're going to take the tomato paste and use it kind of like mustard in a vinaigrette. Typically, in a vinaigrette, you're going to take a little lemon juice, a little mustard, maybe a little minced shallot, maybe a little fresh thyme, and use that mustard for your emulsification. But mm-hmm. now we're going to make a tomato vinaigrette with that instead by using tomato paste instead of the mustard. So when you stir in your olive oil, it kind of it emulsifies into kind of this reddish vinaigrette.
Delightful.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So green beans, mozzarella sliced, the crispy garnish mm-hmm. of the salami, and then the red vinaigrette over top. It's like the Italian flag.
I was going to say, it was
right
very Italiano, these
plate.
Green beans.
All the Greek yogurt and the eggs and pickles have something else.
Save it for another
day. Save it for another day.
Another day. All right, Abigail, you're up.
Oh. This, as soon as I heard salami, I was like, yes, we're going Italian with this for sure. And I was thinking of a Negroni variation. Count Negroni invented this beautiful aperitif cocktail that is equal parts gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. I'd say switch it up a little bit, get a little adventurous, maybe make a Boulevardier variation, which uses rye whiskey or bourbon instead of gin. And I would play with the proportions. Since this is a nice light salad, I want something with a little bit more heft with it, and I would use 1.5 ounces of rye whiskey and 3/4 ounce each of Campari and sweet vermouth. Add a nice big fat lemon twist to that, and you've got a delicious cocktail that's bright, refreshing, and will play very well with all the flavors chef created
there
in this Italian salad.
Whoa, Abigail has definitely been playing this game when she listens to the show. I'm impressed. All right, the next fridge we have comes from Angela Stouffer, and it's chicken breasts. I know, throw them out. That must be for Tom, because we all know how much Tom doesn't like chicken breasts. Bacon.
Now, what don't I like? Be more clear.
Boneless.
I ate a chicken breast last night.
Boneless, skinless chicken breast.
There
I
you
know.
Go. The chicken breast I had last night was beautifully roasted with a big, nice little herb butter under the skin, crunchy skin in a cast iron pan,
mm-hmm.
delicious, salty. Mmm.
All right.
Good chicken breast.
Okay. Okay.
Good, be more clear.
Good clarification.
Yeah.
Good correction. All right. So she's got these chicken breasts. We don't know. Skin on, skin off. We can't know. Bacon, cheeses, lettuce, onions, potatoes, green onion, pineapple, corn tortillas, and you know what? It looks like a little bit of milk. A little bit of milk in the fridge.
That's awesome. Glad the milk was there.
I'm glad.
We'll save that for the kids.
Totally.
Yeah.
What are you going to do, Tom?
I am going to take that chicken breast, put it between a couple of layers of saran wrap or PVC, whatever you would like to call it, mm-hmm. stretch film, and I'm going to pound it out thin, and then I'm going to slice my cheeses thin, and we're going to saute some of the green onions, and we're going to put that in there with the cheese, and then we're going to roll that baby up, toothpick it with bacon around the outside so it has some fat when you're going to saute
mm-hmm.
it, and we're going to sear that, and then at the end of the day, I guess you can make a little pineapple salsa.
Oh,
out of
we don't
that.
Have to do that.
I'm not sure.
I mean, I guess.
But I guess you could make
a little Hawaiian.
Well, yeah,
like
a little Hawaiian.
Ramaki,
but if you take your pineapple and you slice it thin and you bake it in the oven on a cookie sheet
mm-hmm.
and on a cookie sheet cooling rack, what will happen is that a pineapple will dehydrate and caramelize around the edges, right? Because I think when we think about cooking with pineapple, it's just chunks of wet, sloppy pineapple. But now you've got this delicious, intense, dried pineapple flavor
okay.
that would make a nice little relish for the top of this cheesy chicken.
All right, we, so, we
and
you see
want
you.
The chicken. You want to make sure that it's 160 plus in the center, and you want that cheese kind of oozing out the ends.
Make sure it's hot.
Yeah,
all the way through.
And the bacon needs to be crisp all the way around.
All right, Abigail, what are you going to pair with that?
Well, if you have some leftover pineapple, I've recently discovered that infusing Blanc vermouth with pineapple is amazingly delicious. It adds this unctuousness and a little bit of texture and flavor to the Blanc vermouth. And then I would pair that equal parts 50-50 with a dry Fino sherry for this dish. That's going to be dry. It's going to have a little bit of pineapple flavor, beautiful lemon twist, maybe throw in a dash of orange bitters in there to make a bamboo variation or a Adonis variation. And this would go great with that chicken.
Now, when you're in looking at vermouths, which I do often, I love vermouth. I like to cook with vermouth because it's herbaceous.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see the Blanc and you'll see the white vermouth and you'll see the red vermouth,
yep,
right?
There's three different kinds.
So tell us the difference between the Blanc and the white vermouth.
I'd say some Blanc vermouths are more on a flavor profile, similar to sweet vermouths, but I find them a little bit more herbaceous, mm-hmm. a little lighter, and with this, you know, it would pair really nicely with a dry sherry
so
and this
a little
chicken.
Residual sugar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
When we do our fridges, we always are assuming there's mustard, there's ketchup, there's mm-hmm. capers. I mean, there's a lot of little condiments around. What is the perfect set of condiments to have in your fridge if you're coming home from work and you're dying to make yourself an interesting cocktail? Is there things that you can't live without in your fridge?
You need to have whole fruit. Don't use, you know, the lime juice may look like a lime, but it's still a plastic container filled with old lime juice. Mm-hmm. Have some real whole fruit in there. I'd say also have some vermouth on hand. But it is a wine, so it needs to be kept capped. It needs to be kept in the fridge, and you need to consume it within a couple of weeks once you open it.
Mm-hmm. And it's a higher alcohol, right? The vermouth?
It is.
Yeah.
So it's not, that's why it lasts longer than an open bottle of wine would.
I would always suggest, as I do with vinegars and olive oils, buy it in the smallest bottle you can get.
Exactly.
So that you burn through it quicker and it stays fresher then.
Yeah. Make that martini first, but then the next couple of days, just enjoy some vermouth on the rocks with mm-hmm. a twist. It's delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or cook with it. I really do think of deglazing a roast chicken pan. You know,
I love doing that.
Perfect with a bottle of vermouth. Abigail Gullo has been our guest. She's the new general manager and bar manager down there at the State Hotel, the brand new hotel at 2nd and Pike. Thank you so much for visiting.
Thank you so much today. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
Pleasure to have you and to drink your cocktails. Up next, Angela Shen is going to be here with Savor Seattle, and we're going to talk about her new wine passport on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show, typically from the Hot Stove Society, but today we're at Large Media Studios here in the Wallingford area.
That is probably why we're sounding so clear and crisp.
No, exactly. L-A-R-J. If you want to do your own radio show, contact Large Media Studios, mm-hmm. and they can assist you. Sarah, you've been with us all day. What do you think of your new digs here? We're celebrating your new digs.
Oh, man, it's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got it all set up just the way we like it.
Okay, good. We're going to welcome to the show Angela Shen. She is with Savor Seattle, CEO and founder, and also has been taking folks around this town for now, my guess is 15 years.
Gosh, you make me sound so old.
Well, it's getting that way, honeys. Hate to break it to you.
Thankfully, viewers don't have to look at how I look right
You're
now.
You're beautiful. What? How many years?
I know.
12
years. Why are you getting on this show and negging yourself?
Yeah, 12 years. That's a long time.
That's not what the show's about.
And it was right at the beginning of this kind of phenomena that's been it's taken over the country of these food tours or just little city tours. I think the beginning here in Seattle might have been the underground tour, right, in Pioneer Square?
Yeah, for sure. But I figure I'd rather see a city from
above.
The lens of my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and above ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There's so much going on with Taste Washington this weekend. If you're listening to our show, we're in the midst of Taste Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm doing a brunch on Sunday at the Palace Ballroom with Anna Sortoon from Boston, kind of coordinating with the Red Sox being here in town. Are you doing something at the Sanctuary? Is that what I understand?
So there's a pre-funk, I think, tonight at the Sanctuary, so I might pop on by.
Mm-hmm.
But Savor Seattle is offering for just listeners of the show a special discount towards our wine app. So we have a passport product, so a self-guided wine tasting experience for guests who love wine. So if you use the code TASTEWA, T
T-A-S-T-E-W-A, get to save 25% off on our Seattle Wine Passport. And we partner with Lyft on it as our designated driver around town. So lots of the wineries that you'll see at Taste Wa are featured in our Passport product.
And is that what the app is called? Like, if I'm getting on my iPhone and I'm at the App Store, it is called what?
It's called the Savor Seattle app. And within the app, you can access both of our digital Passport products, including the Seattle Wine Passport.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think so many of the wine areas that are little tasting rooms are kind of hidden. They're kind of hard to find, literally. So that's a good idea so people can, when you're walking down Post Alley in the Pike Place Market, you can know which door to walk into. Because like the pink door, after all these years, doesn't have a sign, right? 35 years, no sign for the pink door. Just a pink door.
That's right. They like to keep it cute and quiet, is what it seems
like.
Do
you have a favorite little tasting studio around that you would say tell people to kind of get started at?
You know, so many of our wineries are in the Woodinville area, and I think that's probably half the fun of getting outside of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we do have wineries that we feature that are in the Seattle proper, but one of my personal favorites, especially this time of the year, is Patterson Cellars, because they're right next door to Vivi Pizzeria, so you can go and have a glass of wine outside and have pizza. I mean, that's really like the best of both worlds. I get my carbs, I get my fruit.
That's right, yeah.
Grapes.
So where is this?
It's in Woodinville.
Oh, okay. I thought you were telling me of one downtown. I said, I don't know that.
No, there are a few that we work with in downtown, though. Mm-hmm. So, for example, K. Vintners by Charles Smith and a few others in the Soto area.
So now, does Charles Smith have a tasting room just down by the Boeing Field? I love that one because the jets just feel like they're going to land on your head.
It's really fun to watch.
Yeah.
And again, to your point, Angela, I think, you know, these locations for these wine tasting rooms are not necessarily in the downtown proper, which you may, if you were, say, visiting Seattle anyway, you'd be there anyway. So, you know, going out to Woodinville or maybe to a little bit harder to access area, say, for Charles Smith's tasting room, you get to see a whole different side of the city.
Yeah. And with Lyft, you get, as a user for this wine passport, 5 $10 credits. So that's $50 of free transportation to and from. And you have a whole year to use all of your tastings. Mm. So the app, the passport itself is $59.99. You get $50 worth of free Lyft credit included in that, and 10 tasting locations of your choice. So, I mean, I people ask, like, how does this really work? It's kind of like ClassPass in fitness for wine tasting rooms. Mm-hmm. So I would rather get my workout on drinking my wine than having to work it off. So
We have one of those. So we had called the TD Culinary Passport for our joints.
Oh my gosh. And I remember working on that with you long, long ago.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. We've had a few people, I think maybe 10, have done all the restaurants in one day. But with ours, you have, I want to say it's a year also. And you get to go to all of our joints, and you have to spend $10 in our joints. And if you get them all your passport stamped, once you do that, you get a $100 gift card to spend in any of the restaurants. So you can basically get your money back.
I've used it before. I didn't do it all in one day, though.
That's pretty hard. People take it as a challenge. It's kind of hilarious. One time I did it, they said they were going to do it, and I went to every joint in front of them. I knew exactly where they were going. And met them at each joint. So
that's
pretty
so
fun.
Nice. Yeah.
Although I will say, it takes all day. I wasn't very productive that day.
I mean, you only have like 800 restaurants or something.
So there's wines, you know, it's spring, right? So it's rosé season in my book, even though sometimes I think of rosé being a summer wine. But I think now is fine to get into rosés.
I would also say that a lot of people feel like it's a year-round wine.
I would agree with you, Katie.
Yeah.
I used to feel that way. I kind of think about it now a little bit more like asparagus.
Yeah, you want to welcome the new warmer weather with some rosé. Is that kind of where you're at?
I kind of like to think of it as more seasonal, and I kind of deprive myself of it out of season, and then I'm really ready for it when the season comes.
So you're ready. That's what I'm hearing.
I used to be a rosé drinker all year long, but now I'm kind of just like, I'm going to wait till April. I'm going to have a little steamed asparagus or grilled asparagus. Yum. I'm going to have a little Herbe de Provence aioli on top. Mm. And then I am just going to have my glass of rosé on ice.
I'm coming over for dinner.
There are so many good ones out there. Do you have a favorite, Katie?
No, whatever I can get my hands on. And usually I'm the type of person that I don't feel like I'm particularly knowledgeable when it comes to wine. I am one of those nervous wine orders, so I like to defer to the experts. So I'll go down to Pike and Western in the marketplace and talk to Mike Tier, whoever's working there that day, and have them help me out generally by giving them a price point and generally what I like mm-hmm. in a rosé. And I leave it up to the experts.
Well, the good news about something like that, I don't know if Mike is on your list or not, but the good news about that is they've tasted 100 rosés.
That's what I'm saying.
Kind of narrowed their list down. They probably only carry 5 or 8, maybe mm-hmm. 10 at the most during mm-hmm. season, and they'll have it in their favorite from every price point.
Yeah.
And so, for example, I'm trying to think of the name. Is it Cayuse or Cadence or one of those wineries in the east side of the state that I love their rosé? But it's about $20 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite rosé in the world is that Domaine Tempier rosé from the Bandol region of France, which is $50 a bottle. So you don't buy too many of those during the season, but it's such a treat. It's like having real champagne compared to sparkling wine.
Right? Yes, yeah. Exactly. There's a time and place for all sorts of price points. Like, if it is the most beautiful Saturday that you have seen in many, many months, it might be time to, you know, really celebrate and get a $50 bottle and get the grill going and do the whole dance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Angela, what else do you want to tell us about the Savor Tours? If people want to sign up for your passport, or if they want to sign up for one of your food tours, I think we're in the Market, right? We're in the Market Tour, and we are our restaurants are in the Dolly Bakery does one, I think.
Yeah, so we feature, it's like a Tom Douglas greatest hits on all of our food tours. This is a great time of the year to be out and about in the spring, especially in the market. So on our signature Pike Place Market Tour, we end with the best kind of dessert, crab cakes at Etta's. And our chocolate indulgence tour, we go to Dahlia Bakery. And, of course, because there's white chocolate shavings in the signature coconut cream pie, that had to make it into the chocolate tour.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great time of year to host friends and family visiting from out of town. You can liken us to adult babysitters and send them with us, and we'll take care of them around town. Or come and join one of our digital products. Our food app is out, the Seattle Food Passport, as well as the Seattle Wine Passport. And Tom, C-Town, is on the Seattle Food Passport. So it's a great time of year to try raw oysters. Mm-hmm. And if you come in on the Food Passport, you get to try 2 oysters on the half shell at C-Town.
I'm always thinking about what do families do when their relatives are visiting, right? You know, you can go to the Great Wheel. That's not my favorite, personally. I'd rather go to the Space Needle. It's got some history to it and blah, blah, blah. But there's not – what else can you do as kind of a group and a family? So signing up for one of these food tours is kind mm-hmm. of fun, because you do get taste at all 8 or 10 stops, I want to say. So
mm-hmm. It's a full meal by the time you're done walking around with
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Well, thanks, Angela, for joining us. I appreciate that. Angela Shen, CEO and founder of Savor Seattle, if you want to go check her out online. Up next, it's Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio. And if you want to be part of this fantastic opportunity to win a prize from mm-hmm. one of us for being losers, you just have to go to our Facebook page and send us a question, or come to the radio audience and be active. And there's all sorts of ways to kind of wiggle in and be the winner of these fabulous prizes that we offer.
We are always asking for people to tell us what's in their fridge or what questions they have about cooking. And our winner today is one of the people who told us what's in their fridge. Mm. It's Alexis Carson from our Facebook page. So let's get into it then.
All right.
It is our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. You guys know how it works. Angela, thank you for sticking around to join us in this trivia challenge.
I'm a little nervous right now.
Oh, yeah. No, you're not. You're fine.
I feel like I'm schwitzing over here.
Well, to let you know about what you're about to get into, everyone's going to get 5 questions. Whoever gets the least amount correct has to give something away to our winner, who, as I said this week, is Alexis Carson. So, Tom, What are you giving away?
I'm going to give away breakfast for four at Sea Town in the Pike Place Market.
Delish.
I would suggest you go down early, some sunny morning, and watch the market come alive. We do breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the Sea Town Market Diner. And that's what I'm going to give. It's $100 value, $25 a person.
That sounds amazing. Katie O, what are you going to give?
Ooh, if I lose today, I hope that they want to come to one of the Molly Moon's locations. I will give a gift card so that they can come with their friend and have the 14-flavor flight and maybe pick up a little something to take home.
Right.
Yes, delicious. Angela, if on the off chance that you should lose, what will you be giving away?
In honor of Taste Washington, I'll give a free Seattle wine passport.
Nice. Ooh. $59 value.
Yeah, it's $60.
$60. All right, who wants to go first?
I will go since Thierry Rotor is not here. Give me all of those French questions
Katie.
You like to load it up with.
Yes, you're right. That's exactly what I like to load it up with. The first French question. What type of lettuce was called crisped until the 1920s?
I'm going to guess that's one of my favorite textural lettuces, the iceberg lettuce.
That is correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Good on a burger, nice and shredded. I like that stuff.
It's some good lettuce.
A wedge salad.
All right, your second question. To bard a roast means to do what to it? Is it A, wrap it in fat, B, trim the fat, C, stuff it with herbs, or D, tie it with twine?
Is it to wrap it in fat?
It is indeed. You got it.
Great.
You're doing a great job.
Thanks, Sarah.
All right, your next question. What newly imported substance caused the first major outbreak of tooth decay in Europe in the 1500s?
Is it sugar?
It is indeed. You got it.
Yeah,
tooth decay-causing substance. True or false? Sweating and steaming are the same method of cooking.
That is false.
Yes, you are correct. Your final question. Let's see if you can get 5 out of 5.
All right.
What staple food is often laced with up to 16 additives, including plaster of Paris, to make it stay fresh?
Cereal? A cereal of sorts?
Well, it's bread, so
that's cereal. It's made out of grains. I'd say give it to me.
No.
No. We've gotten two no's. Both of your competitors say no. That's fine. You still got 4 out of 5, Katie.
Okay.
You're doing
all right.
A-okay.
It's fine.
All right. Who's going next?
Oh, Angela, gosh. Be my guest.
All right, Angela, you ready?
So selfless, Tom. Mm.
Yeah.
All right. Give it to me.
How many sizes of chicken eggs does the USDA recognize, including peewee? 4, 6, or 8?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even know peewee was even an egg size. Okay.
Just got to guess.
Peewee, medium, large, jumbo. So I'm going to go with 4?
It's actually 6.
Oh, no.
Rough start.
All right, you can rebound. Bring it back.
All right, stretching it out.
What is the groundnut better known as? I'll give you some options. Walnuts, peanuts, or cashews?
Ground nut.
Yes.
Mm. Walnuts,
delicious
peanuts.
Ground nut.
Mm.
I'm going to have some at the ballpark later.
Peanuts.
That is correct. You got it. Little help from
Thank
Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Oh, I see
he
how
is
it is.
Selfless. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything to take KDO down, I'm fine with.
Hospitable.
Your third question. What sticky sweetener was traditionally used as an antiseptic ointment for cuts and burns?
I'm going to go with honey.
That's correct. Yeah. True or false? Searing meat before cooking it seals the moisture, resulting in a juicier finished dish.
Yes, true.
It's actually false.
What? No!
All right, your fifth question. You're still doing okay. Like, you've gotten 2 out of 4. Let's see if you can make it 3 out of 5.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I'm going to be on Tom's team anymore.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how this last one goes. The soaking of a fruit in liquid so it penetrates the fruit is called reconstitution, maceration, condensation, or emulsification?
The second one.
That is correct, yes. All right.
So macerate a mastodon.
There you go. So that's still pretty good. You got 3 out of 5.
Oh, man, tough crowd in this studio.
Not
Katie O. You can't trust her to throw the quiz. She's too competitive.
She makes for a really great French person, apparently.
There you go. Yeah. Well, let's see if your three out of five is enough to beat Tom here.
No doubt.
No, we'll see. All right, Tom, your first question. What food is the lead source of salmonella poisoning?
What food? Chicken.
That is correct. What is the difference between roasting and baking? I'll give you some options here.
Okay.
Roasting uses higher heat. Roasting requires herbs. Baking is for pies only, or there is no real difference.
Well, in reality, there is no real difference. So I'm going to go with that.
That is correct. Reality won out. All right. Your third question. What ingredient in fresh milk is eventually devoured by bacteria, causing the sour taste?
Lactose.
Yes. All right. Your fourth question. Combination cooking uses what two cooking techniques? Do you want options?
Combination cooking,
you can do
Tom.
All sorts of different ones. Like in Chinatown, they'll take a live crab, they'll cut it up, drop it in the deep fryer with cornstarch on it, and then they'll pull it out and they'll do a wok sear on it with salt and pepper or black bean sauce or something like that. So there's combination cooking.
Well, I'll give you what the options I had were. Wet and dry heat are used. Convection and conduction are both used. Microwave and infrared, or grilling and broiling.
The first one, wet and dry.
That is correct, yes. So you got it anyway. And your final question. Let's see, you could tie with Katie here, or unfortunately, Angela looks like maybe fortunately. They're getting a passport. It'll be great. Yeah. All right, your final question. What do you call it when something is cooked and preserved in its own fat?
Terry.
Where's Terry?
He's in Peru.
Peru! Maybe he's doing this cooking technique?
He's wearing his hat in Peru.
Obviously.
Of course.
It's called confi.
Oui, that is correct.
That's what we say in Paris, that's way.
Way.
So that means that Angela Shen, you are giving a passport, a wine passport, to
Alexis Carson, congratulations.
Nice job, Alexis. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM from Large Studios today. The show is produced by Large Media, and that's LARJ Media, and our lead producer is Sarah Leibovitz. Our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. And if you want to be part of the studio audience where we normally tape, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. It comes with breakfast and hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen. Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.